Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. We have Anna Hebra Flaster, who is an award-winning author, a mother, a wife, and a journalist. And her book, Property of the Revolution, is something y'all want to read because this is such an inspiring story about what makes America great, what it took for people to get here, and the lessons they learned along the way. So, welcome to the studio, Anna.
Oh, it's so nice to see you, Hillary. Thanks for having me.
I'm crying.
Get the Kleenex out. Get the Kleenex ready.
So, all right. Well, you know, I know you came here at 6. Well, tell me where you want to go. I read the book. I love it. I think, you know, I think it's a way to appreciate what got us all here, you know, because everyone has a story. And I did have another refugee girl come from Germany, which, of course, I'm forgetting her name. But again, you know, she just wanted to fit in just like you. It reminded me of that. When, if I think of the name, I will let you know later. But, you know, just I don't think we get what it takes for people to come in those circumstances. So why don't you share what you'd like to share about your journey or your book? I know it's in there. It's beautifully written. And just so you know, she goes back from what it like present to the revolution in Cuba. I don't know if I said that you
came to
Cuba. And it's very interesting, the parallels, right?
Of what we're going through today, you mean?
Just like in the book, like it was like you and then your parents, or what was going on back then, like when they met and before that and stuff like that. So
yeah. No, there's a lot of back and forth. There's a lot of history in the book. And you're absolutely right, Hillary. I don't think that we remember, or we think we know what it takes. We think we know what that immigrant experience is like, but we don't. And that was a big part of the motivation for the book. Besides wanting to honor what I saw happening in my home every day, my multi-generational home with my grandmother, her two daughters, my mother and my aunt, their husbands, and all the children. And we grew up in Cuba, this is typical of our culture. You grow up together intimately. There's no notion of, or the notion of privacy is so different in our culture than it is in American culture, but very intensely together and staying together through all of the political upheaval that happened after the Cuban Revolution, actually going into the Cuban Revolution and the years after. But the main thing was staying together, keeping the family together. It was the source of everything. It was the source of our success in the United States. And there is grief mixed into that. There's joy mixed into that. There's courage. There's love. There's humor. There's a searching and a yearning for your new identity. How are you going to create that? What does it take to do that? How do you honor the past but build a future? And I wanted to honor the courage in the family of what they went through and the entire immigrant experience. I've had readers from World War II Romania, present day Iran, present day Afghanistan, people who say Yeah, it's a story about a Cuban family. I see my family in that. I see my family's experience. So it's so gratifying to know that what I thought was a very personal story turns out to be to transcend my family story, because readers are really connecting it. I had a reader tell me that I sometimes forgot I was reading your memoir. I thought it felt like my memoir. That was an Iranian author who told me that. So I forgot what your question was.
Me too. So, all right. Well, let's go. If you can, I have some questions.
Yes, please.
Okay. So, I mean, I love, the whole family stuff and all that, all the challenges of when you went on your own. I mean, all that, I could feel it. It was tangible, but I think going back to Cuba, your mom fought, not fought, but there was the
Batista.
Batista, and then they won that thinking they were going to get freedom. And then it seemed like it was worse than ever after. Can you just
Yeah.
say a little bit about that? Because that's just for me, like, how did it get worse if they won?
Yeah, that's a great question, Hillary, and it is the trigger for the whole story, if you think about it. My mom did risk her life for the revolution. Fidel Castro was one of three fronts in the 50s battling against Batista, who had taken over the country and stopped following the constitutional democracy and the constitution of 1940. And what everybody wanted, what everyone, not everyone, the vast majority of Cubans wanted, was a return to democracy. And so they thought the rebels were going to do that. And the rebels, the three fronts, all promised that. That was the goal. So my mother had risked her life working to help the rebels by collecting medicine and money for the rebels. And she was caught at one point, as you may remember. And a neighbor who was a police officer under Batista saved her life. And so she was the one of all the viejos, the old people and the family. We lovingly in Latin America, we call our old people viejos, old people. And she was the one in that group of viejos who I think felt most betrayed. She had risked her life at the age of 17, because at 17, you're not afraid of anything, right? And she didn't tell anybody in the family so that if she was caught, no one would know. She broke up with my father so that he wouldn't be compromised. And then the revolution happens, and right away everything changes. Castro says it's not a communist revolution, but then it becomes a communist revolution. Properties are nationalized. First, it's the American companies, the foreign-owned companies, and the Cubans are like, well,
So what? So you said, let me just from so you said there was three.
there were three
Castro
fronts.
was one.
Then in the mountains of the Escambray, in the Escambray Mountains, there was another group. And then the third group was in the city of Havana, in the capital. And they were mostly students, my mother being a student. And they were pretty badass rebels. They were blowing up, they planted bombs, they shot themselves, shot their way through a number of events. So they were militant. They wanted an end to this dictatorship. And by the way, there's this pervasive myth about Cubans wanting a communist revolution. Cubans, the vast majority of Cubans, never knew that it was going to be a communist revolution. They all believed, and they were told by Fidel and others, that it would be a restoration of democracy, and that there would be free elections, and that 1940 constitution would be reinstated. Instead, property got
So he was basically lying. Do you think he knew what he was going
well,
to do ahead?
there were socialists in his group. His brother Raul, who who took over for him briefly while after he passed away, was a diehard communist, Che Guevara also. Che Guevara, I don't know if you know, ran the secret police after the revolution and was very enthusiastic about executions and cleaning and hygiene in the revolutionary society, bragged about it at the UN. And yet I still see these people wearing these Che Guevara t-shirts, you know, for Cubans and anybody who knows, it's like a Hitler, you know, wearing a Hitler. And I've seen it actually. I was looking at an Architectural Digest magazine and one of the photos showed a beautiful apartment in LA with a Che Guevara artwork on the wall, and I thought, there's so many people who still don't know.
Wow.
So
your mother, so they defeat the Batista was a person, right? Who has
Fulgencio? He was a general. He did a bloodless coup in 1952, and took over.
Okay.
Now, society, by the way, society and the economy were free. People could come. Cubans could come and go.
Prior to 1952. Okay.
No. Prior to 19, Castro takes over in 59.
Right.
From 52 to 59, Batista and is a general running the country. There is economic health. It's a vibrant economy. There's freedom, even to criticize Batista, because papers, there were so many television and radio stations and people would criticize Batista. And if they went too far, he'd shut down the TV or the newspaper. But then they'd be back.
Why did they want to defeat him if it was good then?
Well, because they wanted democracy. They had had freedom. They hadn't, you know, you couldn't criticize Batista. You couldn't. There was no sign of when there would be a free election, and they had been used to in the 40s of this,
as we are here,
used to a peaceful democratic process, and that's not what was in store for them. They wanted to return to that, and yes,
they were free. Do you mean before 1952 or even during his reign?
Before 1952, they were free and living in a democratic society. After 52, when Batista comes in, they are free to a different extent. They're not going to have, they don't have free elections anymore.
Okay.
They have a dictator, a brutal dictator who had no problem executing opponents.
Right.
But if you didn't get into politics, you could come and go from Cuba. You could have your business. You could have your little kiosk and sell whatever you wanted to sell, have a little pharmacy, send your children to a private school. All of that ended. And so Castro, when he, after the Bay of Pigs in 1961, when the Cuban exiles who were trained by the CIA here, it was a program that began during the Eisenhower administration, and then Kennedy inherits it. And it happens just 4 months into Kennedy's term. And he's a new president and whatever. And there are a whole bunch of mistakes that happen. And this invasion by Cuban Americans, I think there were 2,000 or so, just fails miserably. And Castro announces after that invasion that this is a communist revolution, and the United States is our enemy, and they can't stand that we're going to be a communist revolution, which was news to everybody, or to the vast majority of people, Cubans.
Wow.
So, and then they saw personal freedoms disappear. So there were denunciations. You could be accused of something, and there'd be a public denunciation where you would have to defend yourself. You couldn't have your little business. You couldn't travel freely within the country or outside of the country.
So 1961, communist. Okay, when did your parents decide they wanted to leave, and then they lost their jobs and stuff?
Right. So they applied by 1964. They had decided that, so let's see, all of 59, 60, 61, 62, 63, 5 years in to the revolution. Now, those weren't peaceful 5 years. They were struggling the whole time and stuff was happening to them. You saw in the book, my father had a gun held to his head at work by one of the new revolutionaries who took over the American plant where he worked, where he had been very happy as a forklift driver. My mother, you know, there are a number of things that happened. I don't know if you remember the ice cream scene in her school where the rebels come in and they want to teach the children a lesson. She says, okay. And they say, children, bow your heads and pray to God for ice cream. And they, you know, everything had disappeared by then. So ice cream was beyond a luxury. They lowered their heads. Okay, raise your heads. Oh, too bad God didn't give you ice cream. Lower your heads again and pray to Fidel for ice cream. And then she saw these soldiers come in with little ice cream cups, put them on the desks, and then raise your heads. Oh, it was pandemonium. They were just so excited. Look what Fidel did for you. And it was at that moment.
That's Castro, right?
That's Castro, Fidel. Kids are taught, I am Fidel. That they're taught to say that in Cuba, in elementary school. I am Fidel. I want to be Fidel. Oh. And that's part of it. So, you know, everybody talks about the supposedly perfect free education. That's part of the cost. It's indoctrination. And you get that from the day you go to forever.
Wow. So they decide they want to leave.
So that was that moment for her.
Okay.
Each person, each viejo had a trigger that shifted them. They said, we can't live here. And so they applied to leave, which was a labyrinthine process. Nobody knew because the country was ruled by edict. Overnight, laws could change. Right. But the basic issue was you had to find this place in the Ministry of the Interior, a certain office, fill out an application declaring yourself an enemy of the revolution. And then you were given a number in a lottery that would say when you could leave the country, but you didn't know if or when you would get that exit visa. When you lost your job.
Yeah.
You didn't have any income and you sat and you waited and you were a target. We were targets. We actually had an act of repudiation against us one night where a mob came to the house and shattered windows. And my father wouldn't even leave the house for many months at a time because if he could have been arrested and just taken for any reason, they didn't need a reason. That's one of the things about a dictatorship. You don't need a reason to do anything.
So when you finally, I remember the story about the guy who went on the boat and disappeared. I mean, people were, so you were waiting to fly out, but some people went, and he was never seen again, right?
No. Well, the rumor was that he had been caught at sea and brought to La Cabaña, which is where they put a lot of people, and executed. Mm. But my father could never corroborate that. But that was what everyone said happened.
Wow.
So we believe that's what happened to him. He was a friend of my father's from work, right, from the factory.
All right. So you got, and please read her book. You'll see it in detail. But so you guys finally get your
exit visa, and that's called a permiso, a permission.
Okay.
I just want to say, Hillary, that I think your viewers should know that even today there are really only a handful of countries in the world that require exit visas of citizens who want to leave, which is a process that you go through. And you may need a visa in the country that you're going to, but only a handful of countries require you to tell your government that you want to travel. Mm. And it's actually a violation of one of the universal human rights in the Declaration of Universal Human Rights, Article 13, the freedom for a human being to move freely within his or her country and outside, and to leave it.
Do you know what those countries are?
I don't, but I imagine it's Korea, the former Syria, I imagine. I don't remember, but it's a very small number of countries.
Okay, so you finally get, how did that happen? I mean, I know you were only six, but.
So that's the opening scene, right? Of Property of the Revolution.
Right.
My book, Property of the Revolution, from a Havana barrio to a New Hampshire mill town, because crazily enough, that's where we ended up in 1967 in December, under, you know, buried in snow.
But the scene, like when they told you, and I know I read it, but I forgot that was at the beginning. Did you have to get out that day? Like, was
no,
it like sudden?
We were sitting down to eat dinner. That night, the guard came into the barrio on a motorcycle with our exit visas. Nobody knew when that was going to happen.
Right.
So he came in, interviewed my father, provoked him, tried to get him into a fight. He gave us the paperwork, said, you're leaving. You need to show up at the airstrip in, you know, tomorrow. It was either tomorrow night or the following night. So he had 48 hours.
Okay.
And give me the keys to your house, because everything in your house was now the property of the revolution, part of the motivation for me choosing that as the title. And then that night, you know, everything that was in the house, by the way, when you applied to leave the country, when you declared yourself an enemy of the revolution, the president of the Comité Para la Defensa de la Revolución, the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, every block had one of these after the revolution. They spied on you. And that the president of that, of our barrios, Comité, came, took an inventory of everything that was in the house. Everything that was there had to be there the day that you got your exit papers. They didn't want you to give your property away. They didn't want you to sell it, certainly, because you couldn't profit after the revolution in a private sale in any way. And so that was one of the things that was happening while this guard was interviewing my father. The Juana, the president of the Comité, was going around counting plates, counting silverware, counting, furniture.
Wow.
And then we slept that night at my uncle's, said goodbye to my, you know, four generations of my family that we never saw again. Most of us never saw again. And then at the airport, we were there with, I estimate 200 other gusanos. We are called worms. Once you applied to leave the country, the government called you worms, gusano, and anybody could call you that. That was just part of what happened. But there were 200 other gusanos and gusanitos, and we were playing, and all night long they were interrogated, and they were threatened with not being able to leave. And actually that night, it's in the book, a big part of the message of the book is ponte guapa, make yourself brave. It was my mother's slogan, my mother's battle cry. And there's an example that happened that night of how she made herself brave. So they told my father, he had a little pimple bump on his chin, and the medics told him that it was leprosy, and so he would not be able to go in the morning to the United States. And my mother, this happened regularly and caused a lot of, you can imagine, they had already decided that if that happened, one of them, whoever was not detained, would take the children, leave the other one behind, and then work to get them out. But my mother, when she heard this, when my father came back from his interrogation, and she said no, and she went over to the medic and talked to him. You know, teachers have a way of talking. And my grandmother, who was pretty meek and mild, got it in her, you know, made herself brave and went over. And between the two teachers, they got the medic to change his mind.
Wow.
But it could have cost them their chance to leave, because right. they could have said, you're being disrespectful, you can't go.
Right. Wow. It's so unbelievable.
Right? It's unbelievable. But it happens. It happens in all of these countries where there's totalitarianism. It doesn't matter whether it's from the left or the right. It's you lose your freedom. And, you know, your whole show is about, it's about these values and these aspirations, joy, let's see, joy, happiness,
purpose
and passion. Yeah. And I was thinking about it, and you can't have those things without freedom.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Human beings need freedom. And, you know, there's,
and it takes something to step over the fear into that brave, into that courage. It takes something. And your mom,
it takes a lot.
Your mom, I mean, they did it.
They did it. They did it in different ways, but they all did it. And I saw it every day of my life. And I wanted readers to feel that when they read Property of the Revolution. I wanted people to feel inspired. I wanted them to see how awesome immigrants are, what they do every day, how they manage loss and hope in the same moment every single day.
Now, can I ask you, I know who did you, I know you had Tia, which is aunt, T.O. was left behind to care for the grandfather?
Yeah, right? Hillary, you read carefully. Good for you. It's always nice.
I didn't know Tia and Tia. Like, I'm like, okay, what if there's more multiple aunts and uncles? And how do you know? I was getting a little confused by the terms, but I was trying to figure out was that his father, T.O.'s father?
No. Okay. You're confused for a good reason.
Okay.
And I'm going to put this up on my website, anacubana.com. I had originally, in an earlier draft of the book, had a family tree.
Yes.
And a timeline. So the family tree, it's really not that complicated, but because there are various tios and tias and abuelos and abuelas, it can be a little confusing. And then the second thing was the timeline. So you saw what was happening in our family, what was happening in the country. So those two things are coming up to my website. I'm looking to make it look pretty. So here, the answer to the question is, Tia is my mother's sister. Right. My Tia means aunt. And I just call her Tia or Tia Silvia. Tio, Angel, was her husband.
Okay.
He stayed behind to take care of his only surviving relative. He was an orphan. And his aunt, his tia, Maria, would have been left completely alone. And he felt this obligation, as many Latinos feel, to take care of their old people. And he was torn, but he knew that they had to get the boys out before they turned of military age, something that kept being lowered by the new government.
Those were his sons from Okay. Then who was Don Manuel?
Don Manuel is the father of my grandmother. He is my great grandfather.
Oh.
So Don Manuel was actually born in Spain. Very poor. He was orphaned too at a young age. And he came to Cuba. And then he had my grandmother had the two daughters.
So was he the one that your grandmother didn't say goodbye to?
Yeah. That was my aunt who didn't say goodbye to him. So my aunt, my mother always said, you know, typical sister rivalry, everything always went her way for your aunt. She always landed on her feet. We had applied in 64, and it was 1967 when we finally left. Tia applied in late 66 and got her papers just a few months later. Nobody could believe it. And the plan had been that we would be here. Tia would bring the boys. Tia wouldn't be alone. But instead, Tia had to come alone with the boys.
And where did she go first?
She had a distant cousin in Lynbrook, New York.
Okay.
And that's where she went.
And then, so you met with her and then you ended up in New Hampshire from there.
Right. When we came out, we went to her apartment. This is also in Property of the Revolution, where you see, I thought it was so cute in her apartment. There were only three of everything. They had, I don't know if you played like this Hillary house, but it, you know, you just had two or three of everything. So in her house, there were three plates and three glasses and three spoons and three forks.
She had the two boys.
And it was the two boys. And I thought it was so cute. They were playing house. And then years later, I realized they only had three plates, three cups.
So, wow. Okay. So, all right. So, all right. So we're at halftime. I just want to say we've gotten you to America now, out of the revolution. Don, okay, so Don Manuel was Abuela's, that's your grandmother who you slept with, who you loved, who you consider mother. That was her father.
Correct.
And who was she so sad for? For him? For her father?
For her father and her brother. So Don Manuel had two children, my grandmother and her brother. Tio Manolo, Uncle Manolo. And Uncle Manolo was the one who convinced my grandmother to leave Cuba with her daughters. My grandmother didn't want to leave Cuba because she wanted to take care of her aging father. Her brother, Tio Manolo, said, I'll take care of Don Manuel, of Papa. You go and be with your daughters, because who's going to take care of those kids when your daughters and their husbands are working? You need to be there. You need to be with your daughters. I'll take care of Papa and we'll see you again someday. But she never saw either one of them again. And they died within a few years of her coming. And that wasn't
the Tio of your mother's sister. That wasn't her husband. That was Abuela's brother.
Oh, so that's right.
Or
her father.
That's why she was so sad.
So sad. And remember, wow. It's 1967. There's no internet. There's no TV in Spanish in New Hampshire. No radio, nothing. So she was completely cut off from her Spanish world, her Spanish culture, and alone. And in winter, we had a blizzard that dumped 18 inches on us within a few days of coming to the to Nashua. And remember, Cubans fear the cold. Talk about things to fear. She thought we were all going to die of pneumonia. That
you have coats and stuff.
We had Salvation Army clothes. We had coats. We even got Salvation Army skates. So we learned to skate at the rink across the street. But we didn't know about indoor heating, chapstick, boots, socks, carpeting, all of those things. It was like going to Mars for us.
Wow.
Nobody knew, spoke English.
Now, you were a kid, but you could sense, obviously, that something
was wrong. Yeah. There were all these signs that something was very wrong. Mm. And that the house was a house pretending to be happy. That all of my family members were pretending to be happy. Do you remember the song Sugar Sugar?
Yeah, Sugar Sugar.
Right. So that came out right after we got here, and I loved that song. And I remember being in the car, in this car that my father was given by another family, and that he had to basically dig out of the snow. It was encased in snow, and he got it to run again. And we were in the car that summer, and it was playing, and I wanted to sing it. And I felt like it was wrong to sing in a car with my family, because I knew that people were really, really sad.
Mm.
And so you think children don't see these things. You think you can hide things, but children know a lot more than they ever let on.
So I know we need to go to the commercial break, but one last question. I know so they were sad, but did they get to be relieved that they had escaped, or do you think the sadness overpowered it?
No. I think, well, for my mother, my father, and my aunt, let's just say my mother and my father were so relieved. Mm-hmm. My father was so happy that he could work as many hours as he wanted to at the factory and put food on the table, that he could find food.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother loved, she always said she felt like she was being suffocated every day living
in
Cuba after mm-hmm. Fidel. And my aunt was also, you know, she had decided for her own reasons, and that's in Property of the Revolution, that she had to get out. But her joy was imperfect because she had left the love of her life behind. And he loved her, but they had to separate at that point. And then my grandmother was happy for everybody, but was deeply in mourning for what she suspected correctly would be the last she'd ever see of her her family, her beloved family again.
But so, okay, so your parents, but could your parents be happy or no because of the atmosphere? Like they
were generally happy, relieved, grateful, joyful, even proud. But when you have, remember, we're in the same house, a small house. You have that happening, and you have the children sort of making their way and having some problems because nothing's ever that easy. Even, you know, kids are, we were generally welcomed in Nashua, New Hampshire. There were not enough Latinos and certainly not enough Cubans to be a threat to anybody. But we still had our issues. So my parents were happy. But they knew that in the same house was my aunt grieving my uncle. Would he ever make it? Would he ever leave? Would he ever make it? My grandmother in a deep, colossal depression. Mm. I write in Property of the Revolution how when I would touch her, she would be wet. She would be damp. She was always damp. Like I'd kiss her and her cheeks were always wet. Ugh. That's how much she cried. That woman never, I mean, from the moment she woke up to the moment she, so imagine, can you be happy?
Right.
Can you be purely happy? You also know you're even at your happiest, you know what you've lost.
Right.
You know that an injustice happened to you and you have to find a way to live with that.
Parents and teachers, imagine a classroom where every child belongs, where kids are seen, known, and part of a real community. That's the world Kikori creates. Kikori isn't just another program. It's hands-on, playful, and filled with activities kids love, all while building skills that matter for life: confidence, kindness, resilience, and teamwork. Kids learn how to regulate themselves, connect with others, and discover the joy of learning that lasts a lifetime. And it works. Schools using Kikori have seen behavioral referrals drop by 25%, and teachers save hours of planning time. Whether you're a teacher building a safe, positive classroom, or a parent wanting your child to grow socially and emotionally, Kikori makes it easy to bring these life skills into everyday learning. So if you're ready to help kids grow stronger, kinder, and more confident while creating a community where every child belongs, visit KikoriApp.com. That's KIKORI, where kids thrive together. This is Earth, a planet of extraordinary beauty filled with life, potential, and possibility. We, the people of this world, are united in our shared humanity. We stand together to embrace the present, heal the past, and create a future where all can thrive. On October 18th, we come together to celebrate what it means to be human, to raise the consciousness of our collective spirit and amplify the best of who we are. From the earth we walk on, to the health of our bodies, to the flourishing of our minds, Humanity Day is about more than just one moment. It's a new beginning.
This is our call to action, to invent a new future where we nurture the earth, each other, and the next generations to come. Join us. One day, one world, one humanity.
Visit iamhumanity.net and be part of something greater.
Together, we'll create a world where humanity thrives.
Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary Show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary Show and Getting Real Movement is all about, being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon, my courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, in case you feel stuck in your life and want to get inspired. How I came out about my no sex life and my marriage in my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KokoriApp.com, and all of our other sponsors. You see their logos going across the bottom. Thank you, everybody, for making this show possible so that we can all elevate the conversation and consciousness of the planet together. And doing that with us is Anna Hebra Flaster, the author of Property of the Revolution, such a fantastic book for anyone with immigrant relatives, or who has immigrated themselves, or who just wants to feel brave and courageous in this crazy world we live in. So, okay. So now, was your even though your abuela, I know, you know, you had said when, you know, later on when you moved out that you missed her cooking, and she did, you know, she was the whatever. I can't.
The matriarch, the hub of the wheel
together. Yeah. Like, she did a lot for you guys. So did she do it even with her sadness? She cooked and she
cared
everybody, right? She was there.
She's in a way taking care of us. Healed her. She had purpose. She had a passion for us.
Yeah.
And she had work to do, which keeps you moving.
Right.
But she had to climb out of a hole in order to finally be happy. She was happy. She was surrounded. She had 7, 8 great-grandchildren in the end. She was cared for lovingly through her last day. She knew she was cherished. She knew how grateful we were for her. And was showered with love, bathed in love.
And do you think she ever could release the sadness? I mean,
I think she
enjoyed it.
Yes, I do. I do. I think she managed to do that. You know, these big griefs that we go through, they do get better with time. Mm-hmm. It gets a little bit easier with time.
Yeah.
And she saw how we thrived in the United States, and she saw how they suffered in Cuba, and knew what would have happened to us had we stayed. Mm. So,
okay. Now, one of the other things that I was struck with, and it was also
with the other little girl who had come to America was torn between you, for you, wanting to fit in as an American and, you know, the shame of, you know, there they go being Cuban again, you know, like you.
Oh, God. We stuck out.
It's been really hard to
we stuck out.
It, you know?
We stuck out. We went wherever we went. There were at least 10 of us speaking in Spanish loudly. And when my parents and my aunt and uncle realized, if they ever noticed that we were shy or embarrassed that they were speaking Spanish, they spoke more loudly. And they called you on it. Are you ashamed of your heritage? You know, because somebody made fun of you? Are you really? It's them. They don't know how awesome Cubans are, because that's kind of it's a good rap and a bad rap on Cubans. We think we're, you know, amazing. And that was a story they told. That was a story that I grew up with, the origin story. Yeah. We were awesome. We beat communism. We won. We beat Fidel. We're not afraid of anything. Look at us go. Animo y adelante. Spirit and onward. And so, yeah, I mean, that's
pretty cool. They did that.
I think it was very deliberate.
Yeah.
It was very deliberate. And they, thank God they did that, because we never grew up thinking of ourselves as victims. And when we faced discrimination, we were like, that was sort of in our heads, like, oh, what idiots. They just don't know anything about our amazing culture. And there were some really hard moments where people showed a lot of hate toward us as the other. And, but that was always the take. And remember, we had all these viejos, all these, you know, I had two mothers, two fathers, well, actually three mothers. And that was their reaction was like, imagine living with that kind of misery in your heart, that kind of hate in your heart. What a poor person to live like that. Anyway, so what else is, you know, going on? And
yeah, wow. And also your mom, when she had, they were accusing that girl at the CVS, and she was innocent, and she stuck up for her. Another punte guapa, where she was like, no, I'm not going to fire her because she's not guilty. And then
she said, you'll have to fire me. That girl didn't steal. I know that girl. And they ended up being wrong. And they said, they admit that, good for CVS, that the regional manager or whatever it was, admitted to the mistake and didn't let his ego get in the way of
admitting
a girl's life, a girl's reputation.
Yeah.
And my mother had seen that happen too much after the revolution. She wasn't going to let it happen. She didn't let it happen there. She got into a few scuffles there defending
the police.
People who were in trouble, and the teacher, the principal at that school.
Mm. Wow. You know, it almost seems like when you step into that braveness, well, I suppose you could get shot. You know what I mean? There's no guarantees. But something about when she stepped into that, they listened. People, like when they were going to execute the guy that saved her, she spoke to them and was like, go home, you know, like, leave him alone. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
And he did.
And they did. And they did. And she said, by the way, her knees were shaking the whole time she confronted that gang that wanted to hang him out for the day. And the people, there were shootouts.
Yeah.
There were people who were killed as the rebels came in. People wanted to settle scores, and they, when there's no due process, innocent people lost their lives. And she always believed in standing up. There's so many stories that aren't even in the book that I could.
Yeah. What she,
and you're right. You're right. Cause you find your courage, and it strengthens you for everything else that you go through in life. You need that courage.
But you have to almost step into it. You have to step out of something that's got you and, like, step into it. And then, you know, you get this strength, you know?
Yeah. Even though you're scared.
Yeah. What others? I mean, there's so much in the book. Again, we'll hold it up, please. There's so much about you, you know, not being able to date and then, you know, going away to college, leaving the family. And then when they broke up to go to different homes, there's so many times when it was almost like you could see the ripping of something. Do you know what I mean? Like that the family that had kept you all going. I mean, it's so beautiful, really, because we don't have that anymore. People don't stay in their families. You know, you wouldn't share a home. You wouldn't not have privacy, you know, but it's such two different cultures that,
yeah,
you know, what would you like to say to leave people with?
With anything. Yeah.
That, you know, you say we don't live like that, but I think we all have that in our, as part of our legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Some family of ours, other than Black Americans and Native Americans, came here, and most likely, even if they came alone, most likely some family members came and they lived this way. They lived the way that we lived, very close, very together, helping each other, intimately. And the price of that is, privacy. You don't have privacy. I mean, it's also not as valued in Latino culture. And independence is also very different in Latino culture. So Americans are all about independence, all about privacy. We have opportunity in this country. It's no big deal for somebody to go to school across the country or take a job across the country. And then the family, you're not going to live like that if that happens, right? If you separate and then you see each other at Christmas and at New Year's, maybe at Thanksgiving. And it's a different kind of adult experience as a family member. We didn't live like that. And that was the gift of having stayed together all that time, is that our children got to experience that too. Even though we were all in New Hampshire or Massachusetts. So every Sunday or Saturday, there was somebody's birthday and the whole 27 member clan showed up.
Wow.
So we got that. And the viejos were living together. But then when my grandmother passed away and my uncle had Parkinson's, Tia and my uncle decided to move into their youngest son's home in their au pair apartment. And that's when we lost our home again. Mm. And the family changed again. And you see in Property of the Revolution, you see the struggle of that. And I'm caught in that struggle because I'm trying to make the sisters make up. But we found a way through that too. And I learned that it's inevitable. Change happens. You know, I think about the galaxy, the form of the of galaxies. There's a center, it spins and spins, and then it falls apart. And then there will be more galaxies. But you can't hold that galaxy in, and it is just part of the process. I got to see the galaxy being created in a foreign place, and serving as the foundation for the next generation's love and success.
Wow.
And we were gifted with that.
Wow.
So out of this horrible experience, we had this tremendous gift. And then we had to see it change again as the family became more American.
Wow.
You know,
right. So I was wrong about the time. We have 2 minutes.
Oh,
well, I know. Oops. My math was not good. So what would you like to say? I know people can go to your website, Ana Cubano.
Cubana.
And we're going to have that underneath your name so that they'll know how to spell it. What else? I mean, they can find your book, Property of the Revolution, on Amazon or anywhere, right? Or on your website.
On the website, there are different buy buttons. And at your local bookstore. And if they don't have it, I encourage people to go to call their local bookstore, ask for it, help your local bookstore.
Okay, great.
And they'll get it through Simon & Schuster.
Okay. All right. Awesome. And then what would you like to leave people with in the last minute? What message?
I would say, ponte guapa ponte guapo, make yourself brave, and talk to your old people. They have a lot to tell you that will help you, that will enrich your life. And they need to be heard.
Mm. Right.
You know, there's so many distractions. And even though we want to speak with our elders, even though we want to have that quality time, there's just so little chance now to be with an elder rocking in a chair and just listening to their stories. Ask them, what did you do when you were, what was life like for you when you were 12? What happened? What was happening during the depression? Talk to me about the hardest thing that ever happened to you. There's a lot of beauty in that, a lot of treasure to mine in that. We need to stop and make some time for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your
Hillary.
Thank you for your beautiful book. Thank you, you know, for your stand for people, for immigrants, for America, for Punta Guapa. You know, it's so important. So just thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Not just for today, but for what you're doing. We need it. We need your message.
Thank you. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started Getting Real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.